Thank you very much, Craig. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net, in one way or another, has been around with us since 1982, and it continues to this day. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., thanks to people like Andy, WA2CDL, and Paul, WS2N, and all the participants out there. So, as always, I want to remind people that if you have any email you'd like to send either me or Paul, and you want to go through me, because I'll relay it, if you have any puzzles, if you have any topics, if you have any questions that you can't get onto the net to actually ask me person to person, just send it off to mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. If there's anything, articles that I read or any subjects that elicit a link, I will post them up on my link page. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. We're trying a little experiment. I'm giving you a little bit of science talk du jour. After 9 p.m., after Andy's corner, if you have a, if you like any of the topics, I have a canned presentation for all of them if you're interested, if we have time. So again, check them out at roy.ac2gs.com. And as always, the chat room is available. You just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that will bring you to the chat room. If you want to tell people how to listen to an audio stream and they don't have access locally and they can't get on Echolink, then tell them to just type into their browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will bring them to an audio stream that I provide. And as always, Mike KC2NJI has his wonderful archive of the technical nets going back to September of 2006, and you can find that by typing in his website, which is amateurradio.tv. Let me drop for a sec. So once again, the idea for tonight will be to take questions of a technical nature, and somewhere between 8:30 and 9 o'clock will be time for Andy, WA2CDL's Andy's Corner. And then I will return, about 10:15, Paul, WS2N, will give us the space report. So, if anyone out there has any questions or topics that they would like to discuss tonight, please give me your call sign and your first name.
K82OGB, just a couple of comments.
Okay, Craig, I got you on the top of the list for comments. Anyone else want to put their name down with any questions or topics for tonight?
K2GJE, subject I've been interested in, Ed.
Okay, very good, Ed. You're number two on the runway. Anyone else want to put their name down for any questions or topics tonight? Please give me your first name and your call sign.
WA2VDH, John, yes.
Okay, very good, John. I'll ask again, because you never know who you might find. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list tonight? Give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. We will start with Craig, KD2OGB. What's your comments for tonight, Craig?
Really happy with the results. I threw Echolink on my phone a couple days ago and gave it a try while I was out in Westside yesterday, and it worked beautifully. Can reach Selden without a hiccup. And I'm really happy. I could pretty much work anywhere with it. And I probably feel like I don't even need to take my HTs down with me anymore if I'm, like, going out to, like, Florida or something, because last year I was considering on bringing my HTs down when I went to Disney, but I don't know what TSA would say about that. But I'm enjoying Echolink so far.
Okay, very good, Craig. Echolink was probably the first pseudo-radio that I ever had. When I first got my license, I didn't even own a handy talkie at that time. I had my cell phone, and I got a call sign, and with the call sign, I could apply to the guys who run Echolink, and I got an account, and I logged into Limark's EchoLink account and talked to another guy in Romania who was also going through EchoLink to the W2VL repeater. So I'm a big fan. I had to use it a lot more when I didn't have antennas and such, and so that kind of colors one's opinion. But one problem, unfortunately, with EchoLink is there's a latency issue, and the people on it can't just kind of hit their push-to-talk button and get into the conversation. They have to wait for us to pause a relatively ungodly amount of seconds in order for it to go through. So it's not a perfect technology, but it certainly is a very useful accessory.
Yeah, I listened on my HT while transmitting through the phone, and it's pretty obvious there is a slight delay. Probably about maybe 2 to 3 seconds. When I spoke to Jeff and to ION, I was kind of getting a little bit of static, but overall I could hear everything he said and everything that he heard on my end, so I'm happy with it. Now, I actually do have a question, just so that probably I'm not really too panicking, but I made a last-second decision not to on the night we left for Kennedy, but have you or anybody else ever had problems with bringing HTs through security? I see the batteries could be questionable, but worst thing they'll do is ask you to power it on just to make sure it's working.
Yeah, it's my understanding that for the most part they just want to demonstrate that it's an operational electronic device, so that you are not packing a empty shell with a lot of plastic explosives and detonating it on the plane. I mean, I haven't gone for any flights lately, but I'd be interested. I'm sure a lot of the people listening in have they ever been hassled trying to get an HT on the airplane?
KC2FYJ, comment.
KC2DXC, comment.
Yeah, Harry first.
I have taken an HT on board an airplane. It was a few years back, but I had no trouble at all. I just would advise not putting it into checked luggage because of the battery issue. Just keep it in your hand-carried luggage.
Don NQHV suggested otherwise, perhaps, with checked baggage, but I'll take your advice.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem I could see is they probably wouldn't want lithium-ion batteries in storage, whereas everyone has them in their cell phone. Even though they can't use them while they're in flight, they can still carry them. So I think you'd have to get a very paranoid security person to tell you that you can't walk in with the handy talkie. There was a K2DXC who wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, it's KB2DXC. Yeah, I've traveled a lot, and I with HTs with scanners in my carry-on, and yeah, I'm more concerned about my 3.5 ounces of applesauce more than the HTs and scanners that I've carried. And if you're going to do anything like put it in the luggage, remove the battery so things don't inadvertently turn itself on, and that would probably cause a little bit of a panic. Back to you.
Zulu.
Come again?
Bravo Zulu with C2. Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
I have found when, not only in this case, but in all cases, when people are looking at a piece of equipment and they don't understand what they're looking at, all they see is a bunch of numbers and knobs and whatever, that they're more apt to question it and give you a hard time than if they knew what they were looking at. So I would say, put it in a suitcase in storage and separate the battery from it, maybe in another bag if you're carrying another bag, or if not, you know, in another part of the suitcase. That's your fact in it.
KC2FYJ, further comment.
Yes, Harry.
I would remind everybody that the TSA agents in the airport all use handy-talkies to communicate with each other. They are going to have no problem recognizing a handheld as a radio.
But then they would have a W2BZ. Then they might know that a handheld, if configured correctly, could trigger a device.
Some chances are they're not going to let it come on, because they want to make sure that it's working properly and not, like, broken in any way, because that would be some red flags immediately that something could go wrong.
Yeah, I think what it amounts to is they're expecting that this is a dummy device that's loaded with explosives. But Harry made a good point that these guys know from handy talkies. It was a problem at one point when cell phones first kind of came into use, and laptops and tablets like the iPad first got into use, and people weren't quite sure what the heck it was for the first month or two. But, you know, at this point, I think they've pretty much seen it all. So I don't think they give you too much of a problem. You know, just if you're going to pack it, pack the lithium battery separately. If you're going to carry it on, make sure that you do have the battery available in case they want you to power it up.
KC2FYJ, further comment?
Yes, Harry.
If you're going to separate the battery and pack the radio, don't pack the battery. Put the battery in your carry-on. If they find a battery in checked bag and they discover it's a lithium-ion battery, they won't put the baggage on the plane.
Yeah, Harry, that's a good point. That's a definite. If you're going to bring lithium batteries, bring them on your person. Don't pack them, because if they find it out, as Harry mentioned, they're going to be very upset with you. But I think that's the best approach. You know, I mean, if you want to hold on to the handy talkie, I really don't think they're going to give you a hard time. But if you want to pack it separately and carry the batteries in your pocket.
Batteries somehow in some kind of to make it so tight that it wouldn't come into contact with anything else. And that's what one of my friends suggested. Like, if you're going to carry multiple batteries, compress them and keep them so that you don't have any of them contacting each other.
Well, I mean, it's always a good practice to figure out, depending upon the geometries of your batteries, covering it up with some kind of insulating material is probably a very good idea. The problem is that the different batteries have different shapes, and their electrodes are in all kinds of different areas. So I guess a plastic bag per battery is a very good idea. I don't know if you necessarily have to make things tight. I don't really see where the tightness is going to add any additional security. You just need something to envelope each individual battery so that the contacts cannot be shorted together or make contact with anything else.
Yep, Kate.
Tax.
Okay, someone was trying to say something. They cut out a few times, so I'm not even sure who it was. So if anyone out there made a comment that I didn't reference, please try again.
KG2RY?
Yes, David.
Hello, Roy. Hello, good evening, everyone. I took an HT on board a plane. I had an extra battery, and I put it in a plastic bag, and I kept it in my pocket. And I was going through the customs, you know. I just put it in the plastic tub, went through the X-ray, and that was it. They didn't even ask me what it was.
Yeah, well, it makes sense to me. Again, this is not a novel piece of equipment in general, and it's very, it's known certainly by the people who are going to be looking at it. They have one clipped to their own belt. So, I again, unless you get someone who's about 3 minutes away from a paranoid break, I don't think they'll give you any trouble.
Thank you.
Okay, now it seems that someone is transmitting without any audio. So there's a little bit of a blip and there's no audio at all. Not even noise. So I don't know who that was. If it's anyone who previously had something to say, check your little connections, check your microphone connections, and try again.
WZBZ, I would give it to her.
Say again, you'd give it to the flight attendant?
I would find a flight attendant to start dating in a romantic way and just give it to her, and then nobody will question anything. Just kidding. Not fun advice.
Oh, well, you tried. What can I tell you? So, Craig, you got a good sense of what the general opinion is. I don't think we live in quite paranoid times where people are that afraid of people blowing up planes, thankfully. They're worried about other things. But, you know, just maintain the simple concepts of not stowing lithium-ion batteries in storage and secure them, in a plastic bag or some insulating material, just to make sure that it doesn't. You know, if you just drop it in your pocket along with your set of keys, it's possible for the keys to short it out and burn a hole in your pants. So, you know, simple stuff.
We'll certainly consider that next time. I even tried looking on the web and didn't really get much help. One person claims that their CW paddle was questionable, but they told them what it was, and they presented their license, and then they're pretty much, continue on, have a good day, and that was it.
Yeah, I think the only flag is things that they're just not accustomed to seeing. And you probably very, very rarely do get any kind of either automatic bug or semi-automatic bug or what have you. So, you know, they might be curious, and they might just want to know what the heck it is. But usually if you give them a reasonable explanation, they'll shrug their shoulders and have you pass on.
Yeah, plus I asked a supervisor along the way back home at Orlando Airport, and they told me the same thing. It isn't really questionable. Worst they'll do is just ask you to power it on. That's it. So I will consider this the next time I go somewhere so that I don't always have to use my phone. Thank you. AC2GS Net Control, KD2OGB.
You're welcome, Craig. Thanks for participating. Next on our list tonight is Ed, K2GJE.
Good evening, Roy. This is Ed. A subject that I've done some research on. I know more of the history than the technical electronic side of it. Before we had GPS, a system was developed during the Second World War called the LORAN. LORAN stands for Long Range Aid to Navigation, and I was looking for someone that might know how it works. I know the history, how it was developed, but I'm looking for...
NY2H?
Yes, Lou.
So you had to listen to more than one LORAN station, and they sent out pulses. So it was simply a timing algorithm, time of arrival of the different pulses, which were transmitted from known positions at known LORAN stations, in a nutshell.
It was primarily aeronautically based, right?
Yeah, that I don't know, but I remember receiving it, and it was like a buzzing or whatever. But that's how it worked. They were I thought they were more for marine mobile, but I guess it could have been for either.
N1YDY.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, there were two different flavors. There was LORAN A and LORAN C. It was a technically a LORAN B, but it was never deployed. And it was, in fact, originally developed for aircraft use. It only had a range of about 200 miles, a little less for Loran A and a little more for Loran C. This was in the Second World War that it was originally developed, but it was brought to fruition, I guess is the right way to put it, during the Cold War, and then they transitioned from Loran A to Loran C, and at that time it became more of a nautical use. But again, 200 miles from chains, there's a couple of different chains that were in existence, it didn't give you, it gave you what's called precision as opposed to accuracy. And if by precision they mean that the results were repeatable. Obviously, accurate means that the results are where you really think you are. So a guy with a Loran, if he knew his TD, time distance, for a set of coordinates so he could get someplace. If he'd been there once, let's say it was a fishing spot. He went there in a boat with a fishing spot, and he said, boy, this is a good one. He could get back to that exact spot, but if what it gave you for a latitude and a longitude was done with an algorithm and it wasn't terribly accurate, if that helps.
DDH with a comment. Yes, John. Yeah, actually, this is also going to be a question I'm going to have, but let me just respond to this. I think it used the difference of the time of arrival from stations that are within the chain, and on the map they would plot these hyperbola, which were lines of constant difference of time arrival of these pulses, and that's how you could infer what your position was. Unlike GPS, it didn't give you latitude and longitude, but you had to use these hyperbolic lines on a map, which was the difference in time arrival. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, that's why they're called TDs, but you're exactly correct. In fact, another name for this is hyperbolic navigation.
KC2SYK. Wikipedia, they call it hyperbolic radio navigation systems. And they cite the accuracy to be something on the range of 10 miles, give or take. And they think that they say that the range went up to as much as 1,500 miles.
KC2FYJ. Were they on medium wave? They were somewhere below or above the AM broadcast, I think.
Loran A operated at 1.85 to and 1.95 megahertz.
KC2FYJ.
Yes, Harry.
Just a sidebar for Lou. It's sort of like the inverse of what we're doing with Green Sky.
Yeah, let me pick it up. Yeah, Harry, that's exactly right. We're putting a direction finding system together, but it's with chains of receivers rather than transmitters. The transmitter would be, let's say, someone who might be jamming or saying silly things on the repeater, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been developing this system for the last couple of months. We're running field tests on it now, and it's working out fairly well. It uses Raspberry Pis and RTL SDR dongles, and it uses those algorithms. It uses MATLAB to do the correlation function. And it's pretty cool, yeah, so it's kind of reverse of what Loran was back to net.
Question, N1YDY?
Yeah, sure, Hank.
So I have to ask, how does it know exactly when the transmitter in question transmits?
KC2FYJ.
Let me pick it up.
KC2FYJ.
Yeah, I think Lou wanted to make a comment, and then we'll hear from you, Harry.
All righty, so it takes snapshots, but the real question, Hank, would be how are the receivers disciplined? You know, are they GPS clock disciplined? No, they're not. Actually, there's a technique where they sample a different frequency, a known frequency, and in this case we're using a digital television transmitter. It's at a known location, and what we do is we correlate the transmissions from that transmitter And once we do that, we switch over to the target frequency, and now we're in sync. So it's a poor man's way of clock discipline, if you will, and it actually works.
Okay, Harry, you wanted to say something?
Sure, and if I understood what the actual question was, it was how do they know what when the signals were being pumped out in Loran, not with the green sky issue. And the answer to that is very simple. They transmitted the signal, and what they transmitted was the time when they transmitted the pulse. It's the same thing that radar does. You send a pulse out that encodes the time, and then when you receive it with a radar set, when you receive it, you see what time it is when you got it back, and now you know the difference in how long it took to go out and back. You divide by two, and that's your one-way time transit. With Loran, you didn't have quite that degree of sophistication because the receiver wasn't synced to the transmitter. But if you got a signal from Loran and then a few moments later you got another one from Loran, you could do a similar kind of calculation based on the time difference between the Loran signals.
No, I was asking about the green sky, but thank you, N1 Whitey White.
Okay, this is AC2GS. Anyone else with any points regarding Loran? Nice historical discussion. Looking at the specs, I'm kind of glad that we have something like GPS. It's a much nicer, you know, it's a newer technology like most technologies are. It's capable of a lot. So I'm thankful we have ours. The Chinese apparently have theirs. And, no doubt the Russians have theirs, so everyone's going up into the sky.
Actually, if I may, the boaters really like to have Loran as a backup for GPS because of its repeatability issue. You know, we're getting good repeatability now with GPSs that are corrected either through satellite or ground-based corrections, RTCM, I believe it is. But boaters really liked having the Loran because you could get back to a particular mark or a particular wreck or a particular fishing spot. N1 Whitey White, I'm clear on that.
Okay, that's an interesting point. You know, some older technology kind of fills in little cracks along the way. So I that's a good thing. The problem is usually they're not long-lived. Eventually the equipment gets old, and instead of repairing or replacing them, they just sell them to the guys on eBay.
NY2H, it's been decommissioned, correct?
Yes, years ago.
Yeah, the Coast Guard demolished the towers, the transmission towers that were in the United States.
Well, that's the nature of old technology, you know. It happens with Fortran and COBOL to a degree. New stuff just kind of takes over. Anyone else with any comments, questions, answers about Loran before we move on to another topic?
Well, this is going to be my question coming up. This is BDH.
Okay, John, please.
Okay, let me give you a little background. I do a lot of low-frequency monitoring. Years ago, I had the RBA-5. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that receiver. It weighs about half a ton. How I got it home from Cortlandt Street years ago was a whole other TechNet story. But anyway, over the years, I've been monitoring low-frequency. I remember monitoring the Omega transmissions. They went at around 12 or 13 or 14 kilohertz. That's been phased out. I also remember hearing Loran C at 100 kilohertz, and that vanished, I think, somewhere around the mid-80s. And that frequency has been clear with no signal on it up to about 3 weeks ago. As a matter of fact, I have my receiver right now set for 100 kilohertz. And if you can hear this, that is a Loran C pulse train.
So I was just wondering if anybody knows if Loran C is being reestablished or has it been recommissioned, or are they going to start up some of the other Loran C chains? Because this this is definitely at 100 kilohertz. That is definitely a Loran C pulse chain. So I wonder if anybody has any information about that. Go ahead.
One way, anyway.
Yes, Hank.
I don't know if this is related to that or not, but there was a proposal about 12 years ago to use the Loran C frequencies in coordination with a new generation of GPS to get the WAS or RTCM type correction directly using Loran. But I don't know if they ever did anything with that.
Yeah, unfortunately, our friend Wikipedia doesn't really tell me anything past the year 2000, when they pretty much describe that it being decommissioned all over the world. I assume there's a lot of used equipment. There's a lot of tinkerers out there, so that might be what's going on.
It's a pretty strong signal. I'm monitoring. I say at 100 kilohertz, it's well over S9. It's well over S9. But...
Okay, someone in the chat room is telling me you're hearing something called ELORAN, and he says the transmitter is located in Cape May County, New Jersey.
By ELORAN, is that the enhanced? I remember reading something about enhanced LORAN. Maybe that's what it is. It is at the same frequency, the same 100 kilohertz frequency. But...
Yeah, apparently this is an enhanced LORAN that is working together with GPS. So that could explain a lot.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable, because there is no QSB on the signal. It's pretty much the same day and night, and at 100 kilohertz, that would put us well within the ground wave distance to Cape May. So that does make sense.
Okay, so once again, people who listen, KD2BD in the chat room, I thank you. There's a font of knowledge sitting around listening to this radio net.
Give my thanks to that station for providing information.
I will indeed. So any other comments on this subject?
Comment, hey, do you want some of the LORAN history over?
I know I'd like some of it.
Hey, please.
Okay, this is K2GJE. The British were ahead of us in the Second World War because they got into the action before us. They had a system on the Lancaster bombers called G, the letter G-E-E, that allowed them to navigate back to England. Our original LORAN was operating in the amateur 160 meter band. That's why for a long time certain areas at 160 meter were restricted to us, and also power was restricted at 160 meters. Let me break. Okay, evidently I did time out. The British were having trouble with their navigational system. The frequency that they used, I believe, was like about our 10-meter band, and they were having trouble, and it only worked line of sight. MIT took what they were doing and from the G system developed Loran. Loran came out of MIT. Loran was basically kept secret during the entire Second World War. I believe it was the Coast Guard that was involved. As we did the island hopping, they would set up these towers, vertical towers, that transmitted Loran signals. And the fellow that mentioned that you had to have a map, now that comes back to me, you had to have a map. The G system only had like a 3-inch CRT. It was not very accurate. The Loran receivers that were in our planes, they had about a 5 or 6 inch CRT. And I believe you saw a line, and there were blips on the line, and I think from that they were, knowing where the station was broadcasting from, they were able to get distance, and I think it was some kind of triangulation that they did. But I'm not totally accurate on that. Let me stand down for a second. When our planes went into Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they operated, believe it or not, on Loran to hit the spot. And that system was basically kept secret during the entire Second World War. The Loran receivers started to become surplus, and they could pick it up, I guess, down on Cortlandt Street, and they wound up on the boats for quite a while. Boaters like to use it. But to the best of my knowledge, all the Loran stations have been decommissioned. Back to Ned, over.
Okay, very good, Ed. I appreciate. I also, if you go to the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, I put up a link to eLoran that Lou, NY2H, was nice enough to text me in the chat room. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Larmar Technical Net. Anyone else with any comments, questions, answers about either Loran or eLoran before we move on to Andy's Corner?
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
Just wanted to throw out there, is anybody who's struggling or new to DMR, and only DMR, I'm not familiar with D-Star and the rest of them, but DMR, number one, I can help. Number two, I have found a way to do it all in Excel, which makes it much easier, much more controllable. So if you could look me up in QRZ if anybody's having trouble and wants to know more about it, or in general, know more about DMR digital radio. Thanks. Back to you. And also I have a question for Andy's Corner, but that's not yet. Thanks, guys.
Okay, very good, Rich. So you heard him. If you're interested in having some problems figuring out DMR, it's a problem with the metaphors that are used. They're very un-ham-like, zones and such, and code plugs. But if Rich has climbed that mountain, so that you don't have to. So if you're interested in asking for some help from him, he's available on the QRZ page. You just look under W2BZ. Okay, I hope my last transmission made any sense, because there's a lot of noise right after it. If you want to ask Rich for help with DMR, just look him up in QRZ W2BZ. Anyway, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limewalk Technical Net, and it is now time for Andy's Corner. So I will summon Andy from his corner.
Okay, very good. Mitch, I got your question, or your comment about a question. Don't be too busy. Okay, very good. Yeah, Loran, it's an interesting subject. We can talk a lot about that, but I haven't been involved with Loran. When I was doing some marine radio work, I had a little bit of experience with it, but that was so many years ago, I don't quite remember. Anyway, so welcome to Andy's Corner. And I hope we have a good audience out there today. So, the topic of it tonight will be a continuation of a topic which I started last week, and even the week before. And basically, it's about impedance matching. And just to bring people up to speed, as I go through my notes here, I'm going to be talking eventually about using transmission lines, which means coax cable or any other type of transmission line, a medium that an RF wave propagates through other than air, other than free space. So it could be open line or twin lead or twisted pair or anything, you know, anything imaginable. But basically what this is going to be talking about, coaxial lines to convert impedances. But I figured, you know, since a coax cable itself is a pretty complicated device, you know, it's a piece of wire, but because of its mechanical design, it offers a certain impedance itself, as most people know. I mean, you know, I think 90% of the hams out there know what a coax cable looks like. And everyone has a cable in their, well, just about everyone has cable in their homes, going to their cable boxes, and that's coax cable, with a different impedance, by the way, but it's still coax. So I figured tonight we'll continue, and we're going to talk about the characteristics of transmission lines, which I touched upon last week. And we'll continue that subject by talking about how the waves, how a radio wave, an RF wave, propagates along that line, which will be an interesting discussion. And unfortunately, there is some pictures which show you how this is done, so I guess you'll have to bear with me. Let me let it drop. As everybody knows, I have a tendency to talk too much. So I have a tendency to time out. So I'm going to keep saying, let me let it drop. But I don't have to say it, but I say it anyway. All right. So but before I go on, let me just find out what Rich's question is pertinent to either this topic or a previous topic. So Rich, W2BZ, go ahead with your question, and we'll go from there.
Okay, thanks, Andy. The question is this. If I buy 100 feet of coax, whether it be RGAU, RGA, whatever, whichever one, and lop off 20 feet of it, what would be the math from beginning to end? I don't think it'd be that complicated, but to calculate how much efficiency and in what, let's say, how should I say this, in what term, whether it be dB or dBm or dBu, whatever, how much efficiency do I lose by, gain, if I take off 20 feet, I'm sorry, how much efficiency do I gain by lessening a 100-foot line of coax down to 80 feet?
Okay. it's a good question. Sometimes you could just, you know, perform an experiment and put a watt meter at the end of a piece of cable and see what the attenuation is per 100 feet or whatever it is, whatever length the cable is. But generally speaking, what I've seen in the past, and somebody else could back me up on this one, is that, you know, coax cables are usually rated as a certain decibel, dB, attenuation. They will always attenuate. You never, you know, coax cables don't have any gain. They have to have losses, which is what I sort of explained last week of how, you know, because of the design of the cable, all cables have losses. So the loss is measured in decibels and dBs, and they're usually weighted for a certain number, like 100 feet, 1,000 feet, 10,000 feet, what have you. So if you could figure out, I'm trying to think of the word, the link, we call it a link budget, which is what I did in the subways when we were calculating the length of a hard line, or in this case, radiacs, which radiacs I didn't touch, by the way. I didn't touch that subject. It's a radiating type of cable. It's a leaky coax that's designed to radiate, and that's what's actually in the subways of New York City. That's the kind of antenna they use to communicate with the trains, because you're going in, because the trains are in tunnels. But, okay, to answer your question, it's rated in decibels per foot, whether it's 100 feet, 1,000 feet, and so on. And you got to look at the specs of that particular coax. And then from there, you can approximate, you know, if it's how many dB per 100 feet, you can take off as many feet as you want, and you can see, you can figure it out from there. I have not seen any direct formula, but I'm sure if I, if you or anyone else could look it up on the internet and do a Google search, you could find the answer right there. But generally speaking, what I'm telling you is the way I've seen it specified as far as cable loss. Okay, does that help? Does that answer your question?
There's a link in the chat room right now for that.
Yeah, thank you, Lou. We talked about this before, me and Rich, and you can look up almost every single type of coax will have a specification sheet that gives you its attenuation dependent upon the band and the length. Usually it's measured in how many decibels of loss per 100 feet. And in the case of Rich's RG58U, it seems to have a spec loss of about 7.1 decibels per 100 feet.
Okay, so the 7.1 decibels per 100 feet equals what would you say on the S meter, even though, because of Andy, we all now know that, you know, it's almost an arbitrary measurement, but something that we could all understand, or most hams could understand. How much, and it wouldn't be loss, it would be gain, because you're actually making the antenna system more efficient.
AC2GS, yes, you would be gaining something along the lines of 0.7 decibels from lopping off, no, actually it was 20 feet, it's twice that. So, you know, 1.4 decibels you would gain.
KG2R1.
Yes, David.
Tell me, Roy, does frequency have any play in this? The higher the frequency, the more potential loss cables can have?
Yes, indeed. If you ever look at the specs, as you go up the frequencies, the attenuation loss gets larger and larger and larger. That's why, although coax cable is great for HF, it's sort of okay for UHF and VHF. When you get into microwaves, it's problematic. Sometimes people use waveguides. Other times,
They finesse it by putting the transmitter so close to the antenna feed that they don't have to worry about the loss.
Hey, when W2PC, Roy, when you were doing your calculations there, when we were talking about this on the phone, that's what I was asking, really. What math were you doing exactly? Go ahead.
The calculation is, the spec sheet says that you get, by the way, I'm sorry, Andy, taking up your time. I'll try and make this short. The spec said that it's a 7.1 decibel loss for 100 feet of RG58U at VHF frequency. So 20 feet of that is 20% of that, and 20% of 7.1 decibels is 1.4 odd decibels. So I'm just doing very simple math.
And on the S meter, what percentage gain would we see?
You probably would not see anything, because you have to keep in mind that as Andy mentioned a month or so ago when he covered S meters, that each S unit is a 6 decibel difference. So if you can imagine, it's approximately 1/6 of an S unit, which is not very easy to see on that meter.
Okay. I think I got it now. Thanks, guys. Back to Andy.
Okay, very good. And, it's always good to get other explanations on the losses of cable. All right, so we're going to move on here, because I got about just about an hour. I do have to go to work tomorrow, so I'm going to start reading here. Hopefully everybody can just follow along, because there's a number of things to cover, including a few formulas. And if anybody, I'm not watching the chat room, by the way, so I don't know what information is being transferred there. But we're going to start by talking a little bit about characteristics of transmission lines, which is what I covered last week, just as a review, and then we'll get into the wave propagation. So all transmission lines, no matter how long they may be, have certain basic characteristics which must be considered. So we will consider two conductor transmission lines. However, the following applies equally to coaxial lines. And this is what I said last week. You know, they're referring to two conductor lines, but coaxial lines will be the same concept. And it says, first, remember that any piece of wire, no matter how short it is, has both inductance and resistance. It is true that a short wire has a very low inductance and a low resistance, but regardless of how low they may be, they cannot be ignored. Thus, even in a very short piece of two-wire transmission line, you know, and this little diagram such as shown in the figure here, we find we have inductance and resistance, as it mentioned. And I described what the transmission line looks like electrically last week. I'm not going to go over that again now. Again, if we consider the two wires in our transmission line, we must remember that we have two pieces of metal separated by a dielectric. Thus, we have capacity between the two conductors that must also be considered. This capacity, even though it may be small, exists regardless of how short we make the line. So, you also know from capacitors and the studies of capacitors that there is no such thing as a perfect capacitor. There will always be some leakage. This leakage we represent by a resistance in parallel with the capacitor, so that when we add the resistance and capacitance across the line, we look at an equivalent circuit like the one that I'm looking at now, which is also known as a lumped constant. And they call it that because you could take each segment individually as a lumped constant.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot about the timer again. W2CDO, let it let the beep. Okay, so The lump constant is, you know, a small segment of a series inductor, and a series resistance, and then a parallel capacitor and a parallel resistor across the capacitor on each side of the line, and as a two-wire line, and that's what it looks like electrically. So that whole network has a certain impedance to it. And attenuation, and that's the reason why, Rich, when you ask the question, you know, there is a certain amount of attenuation that's specified by the manufacturer of any coax cable that you buy, and they specify it by a foot, how many feet, and also frequency. As you go up in frequency, the attenuation increases. So you got to keep that in mind when you buy coax. So for convenience in drawing the schematic of the transmission line, we have represented the inductance and resistance in series with the line as though they were separate from each other and in series with each other. Also, we have represented the capacitance and resistance across the line as being connected across the line in one place, and that's known as a lumped constant. Actually, they are spread out over the entire length of the line rather than lumped into one location. However, we treat the line as though it was made of these lumped constants. Of course, indeed, it would be very difficult to try to show the line schematic in any other way. So if you guys can visualize this, maybe, or maybe not. All right, let me let it drop. Okay, so in figure 3D, let me just go to that figure here. Figure 3D, I don't know where that is. That must be bad. They show a schematic representation of a complete line, and notice that it's simply made up of a number of sections like the one. Okay, so the way I'm describing it is just the way they're talking about. So you connect a generator with some signal source at one end of the line to supply power to it, and the load resistance connected to the other end, and the resistive and reactive values depend on the line construction and the such physical characteristics as the conductor size and the spacing and the type of dielectric used. So those are the main factors, you know, the physical size and, you know, the dielectric, whether it be foam or air dielectric or, can't think of the other word, the other dielectric that they have, a number of different types. Okay, the fact that the transmission line is made up of resistive and reactive components means that the line must offer an impedance to any signal that it carries. And this impedance is called the characteristic impedance or the surge impedance. It depends on the physical construction of the transmission line and hence will be different for different types of lines. Okay, let me let it drop. Okay, now let's consider how radio waves, the radio frequency energy, can be propagated along the transmission line. So, transmission lines. Well, first of all, before I go into that, any questions so far on coax construction? It's awfully quiet out there. I wonder how much of an audience I have. Transmission lines for radio systems vary in length from a few feet to hundreds of feet. A radio wave propagates along the line much the same as it is radiated through space, except that it is guided by the low impedance path offered by the transmission line. As a result, a very high percentage of the radio frequency energy applied to the input of any line arrives at the load or termination period. With efficient design, and there we have the word efficiency, only a small percentage of the energy is lost in the form of either attenuation or radiation from the transmission line. So, as I said, you know, all transmission lines do attenuate to some degree. They don't have any, they don't, you don't get gain out of a transmission line. All right, let me let it drop. The speed at which the wave moves along.